The Mughal artists were not only competing with European artists, they were also competing with the classical Timurid artists. So creating these kind of compositions, referring back to the masters of the Persian tradition and the Persianate world. Right, so really trying to establish themselves or creating this kind of hierarchy and where they're seeing themselves in that kind of silsila or the transmission of knowledge and kind of genealogies. And again, here we're looking at a Sahifa Banu, another female artist that we have in the Mughal court. The next chapter deals with objects, European objects that appear in Mughal paintings and what kind of role do they play. And one of my favorite episodes is about Plato and the organ, as it appears in the story of from the Hamsa of Nizami. And so based on the story, Plato had a competition, started a competition at the court of Alexander the Great. If you don't know, Plato was one of the ministers in Alexander the Great's court, according to Nizami. And to establish his status among the other philosophers at the court. And to show off his abilities, he builds this kind of instrument that within this instrument he can control the life of animals and humans. If he plays a certain type of music, they start dancing and they're happy. If he wants to put them to sleep, he plays another type of music and they all faint. So what you see right now, he's testing it on the animals in the wilderness, and he plays a certain mode and they're all fainting because of his abilities to control their lives. So that's the moment in the story that we're looking at. So when you read Nizami's text, he's talking about this instrument that he calls Urganun. And he says that it's a string instrument with some kind of leather and string that are stretched on it. I don't see a string instrument here. Right, so the word organun and organ were something that was probably conflated on purpose by the artists. And what you see instead is this kind of European-looking organ. Not only that, the organ is having those kind of images of Persian literature and European images on it as well. So thinking about those objects as boundary objects is something that is not marking, not clearly belonging to one or another, right? But something that creating this kind of interesting conversations about the different cosmopolitan aspects of the court. I'm just showing you off. This is an amazing manuscript altogether with incredible images. Right, and of course Plato looks like a Muslim scholar, right? I'm gonna skip that. And then the next chapter deals with the interpretation of landscape and how landscape changes in paintings, and thinking about what we see up here, which is all new images and new features that we see in Mughal paintings before that, and that probably has to do with some European aspects that came into the court. But when we're talking about connections to Europe, so they are using some kind of ideas and techniques, etc., but everything about it has to do with Mughal India. So the architecture, or a lot of the architecture, and the architecture is very mixed. In terms of its idiom, you see European buildings, Hindu shrines and mosques, and then you see those yogis that are meandering or walking in those fields. You also see, and I'm going to show you the top part of the images. You see these kind of idyllic landscapes that everything. The agriculture is blooming and flourishing, and there are travelers that are coming and going on the river boats, and people are walking down those paths, and the city's looking beautiful and prosperous. So all of this has to do with, as I interpret it, as the notion of Mughal policy that brings these kind of notions into being. So they are the cause of this kind of flourishment. And the last chapter has to do with portraiture, because you cannot talk about the Mughals and not talk about portraiture. And that's one of the things that they're famous for. And so in the chapter I deal with all kinds of aspects of portraiture, but one of the things that I want to mention here is the role of portraiture and the change in portraiture as a kind of a lifelike image, or something that tries to convey more closely, I don't want to say realistic, but I'm going to say realistic images, right, of the rulers, and then the connection of these, the notion of lifelike portraiture to the notion of physiognomy. That was something that was very strong at the Mughal court, and then the power of these lifelike images to be used as surrogates for actual people. So we have all kinds of episodes at the courts that we hear about Jahangir, that he got pissed at someone, and what he does, instead of yelling at the actual person, they bring his portrait and he's shaming the portrait in front of everyone else, and things like that. Akbar has dreams that has to do with portraits of enemies that he kills through the painting, etc. So the idea of lifelike images, they have certain properties and aspects of them that are really interesting. Also interesting in that context is the ability to create, because of the idea of physiognomy, to create some kind of a dynastic portrait. So, of course, Jahangir probably did not look exactly like that, and Akbar too. And so we're talking about idealized figures, but also idealized figures to show certain features, and certain features that would then convey certain characters, because your appearance based on physiognomy tells us who you are as a person and what are your abilities. So the way that they look like, the one of the reasons probably why they look like this is also to convey these kind of specific characteristics for themselves. So that kind of portraiture was used as a dynastic language, if you wish, that had to do with their establishing their position in India and beyond, and connected to to their cosmopolitan court. And the last thing that I want to talk about is the fact that they're both holding images. So I'm sorry, this is my picture. That's what it looks like when you send me to take pictures in a museum. It comes out terrible. Don't do that anymore. But it was at the National Museum in Delhi, and that's the best I could do. So it's Akbar holding an image of the Madonna, right? And Jahangir holding an image of Akbar, right? So the idea of these kind of portraits, so there is a portrait within a portrait, right? And the idea of them creating this kind of notion of the cult, or related to the cult of the emperor. We know from primary sources that there were close circles of people at the court, and upon their connection, or the kind of various connections that they form with the emperors, they would receive emblems with portraits of the ruler. So perhaps falling on this kind of dynastic lineage and creation, the connection between Akbar and Jahangir, and then Akbar and the Virgin, and then we have those two female figures that are holding portraits of Jahangir as well, perhaps connected to those circles. So just to kind of, I've talked way too much, and so just to sum up, to thinking about all these kind of ways in which the artists were co-opting and reconfiguring and creating a very new and different artistic language that has to do with some connections to Europe, but not the connections that has been spoke about earlier. So if you would like to start with the questions and answers.
Mm-hmm. sick?
Yeah, I do.
Thank you, Mika.
Thank you.
That was an incredible sort of summary of what Mika actually has achieved in the book. What sort of struck me when I read it is that I think there are a number of scholars who, as Mika mentioned earlier, have sort of looked at Europe and India. It's a favorite subject matter, and how can you not? I mean, when you see these images, and first of all, you see the Indian images, and of course, you know, it looks familiar. Okay, so you hear about Indian painting, but suddenly you see something that sort of doesn't look, you know, it looks European, so it's accessible. So then, of course, you want to find the original. And bingo, you actually, in the case of Mughal art, you can find the Dürer or, you know, one of the Dutch paintings. So that has been sort of the approach for many years. So a new generation of scholars have sort of tried to look at it in a different way. And what Mika has done, which is such an important contribution, and is the fact that she has sort of pulled all of this together, all the sort of different attempts by other scholars to sort of, you know, put together a different kind of picture. She sort of pulled it together by creating these case studies of looking at particular paintings and really going into depth and sort of unpacking it, as she has said. And that's, again, it's a great contribution for all of us, and I think for all of you who, you know, I hope you are excited by Mughal painting. So from my perspective, it's an incredible contribution. One thing that I was going to ask you, Mika, is that you have focused on a very particular time period, on a very sort of particular relationship, because you think of the Mughals, but Mughals are just one part of this whole, you know, huge geographic entity, which is called India, and there were other people walking around there as well, and other artists. There were artists from Iran, there were Hindu artists. So your methodology is also quite original and different, because it sort of really sort of focuses on this moment and on this development. So I wanted to ask you about why, what is it that you found out about it, and what makes it so important?
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent question. So usually when you read about the relationship between Mughal art and European materials, there is this kind of broad survey, like of from the period of Akbar until Shah Jahan. And I think by doing that, we're missing really the ideas of what lies behind those relationships, and why would it be interesting for any Mughal ruler or patron or artist to be engaged with these kind of materials. And not because Renaissance art is the greatest thing that ever happened to mankind, right? So I had to kind of separate it from everything else, or I wanted to separate it from everything else, and just look at this kind of angle, because Akbar starts this policy of Sulh-i Kul, and that policy enables or kind of triggers this interest in others, and in a way he creates this kind of equilibrium in the empires that opens it up to a lot of I don't want to say foreigners, but a lot to other groups, and there is an interest in others. And so the Jesuits do play a role, but not the only role. There are all kinds of merchants, and of course the various trade companies that are coming into the court. and the objects that they bring, because every time you go to the court, you have to bring gifts. You cannot just show up, right? That's not how it works. So there is this whole kind of thing that is happening, and that's because of his, I see that starting because of his policy. Jahangir continues to a certain degree, he continues these kind of ideas. And then he changes with Shah Jahan. Shah Jahan is no longer interested, definitely not in Christianity and not in the Jesuits in the same kind of way. And so there is a shift in the material that comes into India in the way he is looking at, or the way artists are utilizing the materials. So I thought just looking at Akbar and Jahangir would make more sense, a more coherent group in terms of the time and the geography that would correspond to the policy that enabled all of that. So,
right, thank you. Now, one other question, and that sort of actually, especially sort of strikes one with these images. So, you suddenly in India, you get these images that are completely different, original. And really, they sort of break the mold. They take the sort of inspired, or at least they select or appropriate certain elements from, you know, European, and sort of make it their own. So it's like really original and really different from what was happening before. Correct. So you have these albums, you have these manuscripts. Who was seeing them? Why were they doing it? I mean, where is the audience?
Oh, that's a million-dollar question, right?
Sorry, it was a little trick question.
So oftentimes, so we do have on some of those manuscripts, we have notations by the librarian, or sometimes even by the emperors themselves when they were viewing it. So there is a record of that. But I think most of the time was really for a very, very small group of elite at the court that had access to the imperial library or the imperial treasury, or that it was given as gifts for certain occasions, for a marriage or in diplomatic relationships or any kind of an exchange like that. But otherwise, really, it was not seen by so many. And that's why I think it's we cannot talk about those images as propaganda at all, and it's more kind of a self-image and self-reflecting or kind of projecting of their own image. Mm-hmm. So something very kind of elite-like.
Mm-hmm. But I'm sort of also...
Like Gelman Library, right? You cannot all go into Gelman Library.
But I think also, I guess, I mean, as you sort of say, as gifts...
It's recorded, I should not say anything.
As gifts, do we know that they were given as gifts to ambassadors who came from Europe? You know, to make the point that, you know, our artists can draw just as well as Dürer. Thank you very much. So is that another use?
So oftentimes, when we have records of when Jahangir, the people who are assigned to trade with Jahangir at the court, is coming, and he wants to leave back to go back to England, and Jahangir gives him a portrait. So there were these kind of official portraits that were part of the gifts exchange. He also tricks him. The Mughals were very playful with the Europeans. They pulled all kinds of tricks on them. They were there to amuse. They saw the Europeans were there also to amuse them. So, for example, in one of the texts that we have, Jahangir, so that person comes to the court and give Jahangir a gift, and one of them is a painting. And then several weeks later, Jahangir invites him to the court. What Jahangir assigned his artists in the meantime was to make several copies of this image. So he invites the European ambassador back, and he shows him like four or five versions of the same painting on a board, and asks him, "Which one? Can you tell me which one is the European image?" And not only that, later on he tells him, he said, you brought me this image as a gift, so you really should know what is going on here. And the poor guy could not tell the difference. And then he said, no, because the light was dark, and and I couldn't see well. He gives all kinds of excuses. It's beautiful, but he could not figure that out. So if they wanted to make copies, like one-to-one copies of the European materials, they could. They were not interested. They were making their own stuff.
Versions.
I don't know if anybody has any questions.
Well, I just had a question to go off of what you just said. You said that it was sort of a way to show their self-image. So do you think it was also a way of sort of like legitimizing themselves throughout history, like placing their legacy in history, if you will?
I think very much so. Right, because the Mughals, like their Timurid ancestors, were very much historically conscious. Right, that was something that they cared a lot about. They were dealing with lineages and genealogies, and these things were really important. So I believe some of those paintings were connected to that. Hence the creation of this kind of dynastic portrait or profile. Right, that they all look connected to also to the ancestors the way they want to be shown. Right, so that was part of legitimizing themselves, but to themselves. Right, it's not that this is going to be now printed in like 50,000 copies and everyone is going to see that. Right, so it's something that was more interior to a certain elite than exterior. Yeah.
So you mentioned that prior to writing this book, the trend in art history was to, I guess, discredit Mughal art as sort of a derivative of European styles, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what spawned that trend prior to your work? Where did this notion come from in the first place?
Wow, what questions I'm getting here from my own students. Well, I think we are all products of our times, right? So when you look at this, you have to think about globalism, right? And global connections and ideas of diversity, etc. So my scholarship is definitely a result of these kind of notions. And I think when we're looking at earlier trends, right, there is more kind of a Eurocentric tradition. Not to say colonialists, but kind of residues of colonialist tradition that is seeing Renaissance as really the gift to men, and that there is nothing better than this, and not thinking that not everybody understood that in the same way elsewhere. I don't know, Massimo, do you have a different interpretation?
No, I think that's very true. And the other thing is, I think many of the early scholars of Mughal painting, were really drawn to these images because of their visual qualities. Very few of them, when you think of the early generation,
mm-hmm.
Really could read Persian, which was the language that they used at court. And I think, one of the things that is obvious with your book and the sort of the new generation that looks at this material differently is the fact that they're actually reading the text that goes with these images. And that's, the same thing with Hindu paintings, that, people are actually reading what's written on the back. Whoa. And it gives you a different, it gives you a different interpretation. And it sort of gives you a broader, larger context. And I think that's another thing. Now, if you want to get a PhD in art history, you have to have your languages, because it is so critical to look at primary text and to sort of see how these images were used. So I think that's another another reason that there's sort of a shift in scholarship.
Right.
You mentioned the Jesuits. Now, the Jesuits came originally to the Portuguese and the Goa region.
Actually, Kochi and then Goa.
So are these Jesuits you refer to originally from the Portuguese sort of
Estado